Hi, Mickey.
Hey, Bob. It's a great week. We got the Ames straw poll coming up. We got
the what coming up?
Would you stop interrupting me, Bob? That's really annoying when you do that.
I know. But what did you say?
I mean, Jesus. This is my Stoller technique. Seems to work for him. Did you see that?
No, I didn't. I've understood very little of what you've said so far, but it sounds like great entertainment.
Matt Stoller in a debate with Con Carroll.
Oh, right. Yeah. He was, he got a little grief in the comments section for being unduly sensitive to the...
That was like a deep dispositional thing, because you could tell he was trying to be nice. He was trying desperately to be nice. He praised Carroll for, like, well-considered insights, but he couldn't help but being pissy. It was great. It was great video, Bob.
It's great TV. Reality TV, man.
And you said you felt kind of sick?
Oh, before we got on the air, I did mention to you about 2 minutes ago that I felt like I might throw up. But, you know, I don't think we want to spoil it. If it does happen, I don't think we want to spoil it for our viewers by giving them that little preview.
No, now they're it's like waiting for Dan Rather to explode.
Yeah.
Waiting for you to be sick. I hope we get the sound.
We'll get everything, buddy.
That'd be great. Okay.
We'll definitely get the visuals.
Anyway, sorry, I wasn't really being pissy. I was just imitating Matt Stoller.
Yeah.
So.
Well, I.
Part of my gratuitous attempt to bait the Daily Kos crowd, even though...
As usual, yeah, you're being antagonistic toward the Netroots.
Even though they're essentially a benign force.
They are. We like them all. Well, I'm happy because the air conditioning's on after 2 week hiatus. The AC guy came yesterday. And those pop social science theories about to explain why countries near the equator aren't exactly paragons of economic development, you know, the idea that it's just too hot to be very productive. I am a believer. I am an adherent of those theories now.
Cool. But why didn't the crime rate go down then with the advent of air conditioning?
Why didn't the crime rate go down? Well, that's a challenge to my thesis, I guess. Criminal productivity shouldn't it have gone up? Shouldn't criminal productivity have gone up?
There you go. No, you figured out a way to save the theory.
Oh, okay. Thank you.
Except the criminals got more efficient.
Okay. Well, that's it for this dialogue, I guess.
Okay.
We settled the big one.
The lead theory of criminality probably has more traction than the air conditioning theory.
Hey, can I ask you a very challenging question that I didn't warn you about, Mickey?
Yes.
Okay. This is something I wish I had thought of back when we were debating immigration. I think it's a profound insight. See what you think. You know, you were belittling the idea of a virtual fence, you know, a high-tech thing that just senses intruders and so on. You're a big fan of a real fence along the border.
I'm skeptical of the claims for a high-tech fence.
Today's question is, how is a virtual fence actually superior to even the most effective real fence, even a real fence that's 100% effective?
Because it's not an affront to our neighbors south of the border.
No. I think you drew on a Bob stereotype there, Mickey. And that led you astray in answering that question. The real answer is, now you may remember when we started talking about immigration, I said one reason I am definitely in favor of securing the border is that, you know, it's a good way to stop terrorists. You know, you got a terrorist coming across the border with like a nuke in a suitcase, you know.
Right.
You don't want them coming in the country. Well, the thing about a virtual fence is you don't just stop them, you apprehend them. Okay, they're not still at large. You confiscate the nuke.
I don't understand. If it's a fence, they don't even get in.
Right, but wouldn't we rather catch the terrorists than have them still out there?
Oh, this is like a flypaper strategy. They should come to America so we can catch them. So we should actually have open borders and invite them in.
That would be going too far, Mickey.
And entrap them. I would just keep them out, Bob. And anyway, any fence is also going to have cameras. The point is you do the fence and then the cameras are an add-on. You don't rely on the cameras...
Well, yeah, but if they show up at the fence and just give up, you never apprehend them.
Well, that's good. Even better if they give up in Pakistan.
No,
at some
it's
point,
not.
We want them to give up. We don't want them to come all the way here so we can apprehend 9 of the 10 people with nukes. That's not good enough.
Mickey, I don't know. I think you're, like, flailing around to try to belittle a really acute analytical
it's
point.
It's not the analytics are all against you. At no point do we want to encourage people to make progress into sneaking into America so we can catch them. We want to deter them at every stage of the process and have whatever means we have of detecting them should they get through. There'll be plenty of people who get past the fence who we can then tape with video cameras and apprehend.
Well, obviously, I'm talking about an effective virtual fence. But are you saying you would rather have terrorist with a nuke still at large in Mexico, dying to get into America, than have him in jail and have the nuke confiscated?
Isn't the logic that there will always be terrorists, so the point is to deter them?
Mickey, I'm going to let our commenters take over.
It seems to me there's some parallel. Okay, maybe you've got me, but
I'm going to let our commenters pass judgment on this one.
It seems to me there is a parallel to Iraq where you are advocating a sort of flypaper strategy. I guess the difference is that your strategy does not actually encourage the creation of more terrorists.
I will abide by the decision of our commenters.
No, you cop out just because you think you're ahead. Anyway,
yeah. I don't want to waste any more time. I know, it's like the 10-run rule in Little League. I mean, can we go home now?
You're not that far ahead.
It does
seem to me that your argument implies that we would want to encourage people with nukes to come to America so we can arrest them, and in some specific cases we might. But in general, as a policy, I think making it hard for people with nukes to come to America, knowing that we can never keep track of everyone, is probably a better policy.
Let the viewers decide.
Okay. There may be some terrorists among our viewers, though.
Well, then they would know more than any of us about this issue.
Okay, that's good. We want their comments.
We want their, yes.
Okay.
We seek a diverse audience, and we cherish the diversity.
Okay, moving right along.
What are we going to talk about? How do you want to build this next one? Are we just talking about crazy Jim Cramer, or are we talking about this very serious issue of the stock market in crisis over these bad mortgages?
I'm talking about crazy Jim Cramer because he had this... there's an important point about the rich, not so much about stock markets. We had crazy Jim Cramer saying, sort of having a planned meltdown on television, which was all over the web on Drudge, about how the Fed...
Can I stop you, Mickey, and ask our viewers to maybe click pause here, click on the link of the video, which is right next to the video box. You should actually go to 1:25 because the video is kind of screwed up, and they've got first a fragmentary version of the meltdown, and then the whole Jim Cramer meltdown.
There's a better version on YouTube I can give you. So
okay, maybe you shouldn't go to 1:25 then, unless it says to. Okay.
And especially if you're listening on a podcast, they're going to be totally twiddling their thumbs at this point, Bob.
Yeah, I know. I'm sorry. I apologize to them.
We're a multi-platform outfit.
I know.
Try to please one platform.
I know. I'm sorry.
Anyway, the Cramer video is there of him melting down. Basically, he said, look, the Fed doesn't realize what a serious crisis this credit crunch is. They're keeping interest rates high. As a result, some people are going to go broke. And Bernanke has to, this is Armageddon, and Bernanke has to stop being an academic and save the economy by cutting interest rates. He actually used the word Armageddon. Forcefully, and half the time he pretends he's defending the forgotten man. We're stopping the next depression. The forgotten man would be the people who bought their houses with subprime loans and are now might lose their houses, have to turn in the keys, as he said, because they can't. Their adjustable rates are going up, but really he's talking about his friends. He said his friends might lose their jobs. His friends are. In charge of the bundling these mortgages into tradable securities at big firms, and they might lose their jobs. And the obvious hypocrisy is that the reason Jim Cramer's friends make so much money is because they're supposed to be taking risks. They're not supposed to miscalculate about the credit market. They're not supposed to miscalculate about the ability of subprime mortgage holders to repay their loans. But then when they do miscalculate and they lose their job, Jim Cramer goes on TV and calls on the Fed to save their jobs. There's like some sort of ratchet effect that Jim Cramer's friends always get rich, but they can never get poorer. They never have to trade down to a smaller house in Connecticut or sell the back 40 to their neighbor or, buy a Bentley instead of a Ferrari. There was just something so anti-capitalist about this that Cramer's all for capitalism, but when his friends lose their jobs, all of a sudden he's for government intervention.
Yeah, I mean...
That's my point.
Yeah, I mean, first of all, I would say, it's always hard to tell whether he's really having a meltdown. I mean, I think the show is called Mad Money. I mean, half of the entendre there is He looks like a madman on the show. He's always kind of going ballistic. He's always looks like he's had too much coffee. But this was, so far as I know, the record setter for his show. And he did look like he was genuinely...
Well, he said in later interviews that it was planned. So it's clearly...
Well, I would say that, too.
Yeah.
You know?
It's fully both.
But anyway, it's also clear that his friends really have been calling him. And I'm sure the way they've been pitching it to him is, as he says, that this is a crisis, the country's in crisis, the financial markets are in crisis, you know, we're calling you on behalf of the public good. I don't doubt that they cast it that way. But I also don't doubt, as you said, that what was really motivating them.
He actually says at one point, my friend might lose his job.
Yeah, he may.
And Bear Stearns is in trouble. This does not seem like a crisis to me. This seems like the sort of story where you're in the library looking over the clip file, and you say, oh, I guess back in 2007 they were worried about the credit crunch. Boy, that was a blip. It just doesn't seem like a big deal. People have to talk about something. Jim Cramer's paid to go ballistic. Columnists are paid to opine about something.
Did you happen to check the stock market before we started taping this?
No.
It's down 280 points on a day, which, look, I agree. We've seen over the last 20 years, you can have an 8, 9, 10% correction, and life goes on. Nobody actually dies, right?
Nobody actually dies. Not only that, the unemployment rate doesn't even go up. I mean, the Fed said, look, we'll intervene to save the economy when we start worrying about the people getting unemployed.
Yeah.
And that hasn't happened. It's just Jim Cramer's friends losing their money, and I'm losing money. So, big deal.
Do you know Jim Cramer?
I work with him at The American Lawyer, yes.
Yeah. I edited what may have been his first piece for The New Republic back before he was like a famous TV journalist. He didn't welcome all my editorial interventions. Can I make a quasi-serious point about the credit thing?
Yeah.
I went to this talk by Ellen Seidman of the New America Foundation at a New America Foundation thing, and she's this, like, eminent person who's been on, you know, the board of the FDIC, had all of these positions having to do with regulatory agencies and stuff. And in talking to her afterwards, it became clear one thing that's actually changed in these credit markets is that in the old days, you know, there was a bank that assessed the risk before giving you the mortgage, and if you defaulted, they were on the hook. So they paid a lot of attention. It turns out that now, through the magic of technology, the division of labor here is so elaborate that the people deciding whether, the people evaluating you, deciding whether to give you the mortgage, are not the people who are on the hook if you default. And that's a very serious thing.
Because they immediately resell the security to somebody else, and they're off of them.
Whatever. I think it's something like that. Now, you can imagine the feedback system still working in the sense we make our living by having a reputation for, you know, evaluating these things wisely.
We have tougher criteria, so our mortgage-backed securities are better than your mortgage-backed securities.
But I kind of suspect, I mean, first of all, she agreed, this is the thing, and it doesn't have to be that way, and she knows a lot more than I do. So I kind of suspect there is a problem in the feedback system. But I certainly agree with you that, you know, the way capitalism works is people who take bad risks are punished for them. And someone has to pay the price for all the bad judgment that was apparently exercised. And Bear Stearns, I guess, and people like that bought into this in a big way. And for good things to happen in the future, whether it just means, you know, the evaluators choosing to have better judgment or there being actual reform, I don't know what's in order. But for good things to happen, Bear Stearns has to suffer. They screwed up.
What you say is also interesting is the inability of sort of the objective criteria that probably these banks use to capture the X factor that an actual officer sitting in front of these people might be able to discern if his own hide was on the line, as you say, in terms of if these people defaulted on their loan.
Well, there's the further factor that in the old days, the people doing the evaluation, you know, they were like your neighbors. I mean, they had heard that you had a drinking problem or something, you know.
Right, and they had maybe some techniques for making you repay the loan that Bear Stearns doesn't have. Did you see the movie Once?
No, my wife and kids are trying to get me to go. Should I go?
Oh, yeah. I mean, it's got some schlocky scenes in it, but it's a good movie. But the
good music, good tunes.
There's a scene in it where, like, this scruffy street musician goes to the bank and asks for a loan to make his CD because he's got to take it to London and make money. And he gets the loan. That's the most implausible thing.
Wait, he does what with the loan?
He gets it. The bank officer sort of does exactly what you say bank officers used to do, which is he senses that this guy's going to be a winner and gives him a loan to make his CD, which is totally insane.
Yeah.
What are the odds that any one CD is going to make it big? And that sort of thing doesn't happen anymore, I don't think.
Maybe quite, it still happens. Quite so. It's done online virtually.
Still happens in Ireland, maybe.
The one final irony here is Kramer, in this clip, complains, "We'll spend billions in Iraq to build homes, but we have thousands of people losing their homes right now." I mean, again, acting as if, you know, he's a populist or something. But anyway, as for the Iraq part, I mean, as I recall, in the run-up of the Iraq War, he and Lawrence Kudlow, did they have some show or something? They were always on TV together.
They used to, but that was years ago.
I'm quite certain I remember them.
I was on their show.
Well, I'm quite certain I remember them deriding almost, you know, in a hail of laughter, people who thought we shouldn't invade Iraq. I don't know why they thought it was really their mandate on a financial show to encourage the invasion of Iraq, but I'm pretty sure Jim Cramer did. So for him to now say, you know, there are no consequences of taking a bad risk in that invasion is kind of eerily parallel to what he's saying in the financial realm.
Are you
going
to back up this charge with documentation now? I think you've made some work for yourself.
I defy people to contradict me, and I will apologize slavishly. But
that's cheap.
What?
That's cheap.
On the internet, you just let the internet do your research for you.
Okay.
That prove me wrong. Make my day. Bring it on. Whatever.
It's just so you give back the keys to your house because the house isn't destroyed. Somebody else moves in.
Right.
I mean, it's not the parallel to Iraq is insane. Kramer's unhinged, but he I guess that's his.
It's a living
money. Yeah. Well, that's it for me and Kramer.
That's it for me and the mortgage market. So we're going to talk about Obama.
Yeah, you.
I had very high hopes for Obama, but I fear that he has by now demonstrated that maybe his political intuition is just not ready for prime time.
Do
you sense, first of all, that is this a widespread feeling? Am I the only one who thinks that the last couple of weeks have shown that he's just not ready?
You're definitely not the only one. There's an article I can send you from. It was posted on Real Clear Politics from one of the Chicago papers, I think.
Yeah, but was that by Tom Bevin?
No, it was not. It was by some guy named Huntley, I think.
Was it by a liberal who actually genuinely had, you know, wanted Obama to succeed?
I think it was by a neutral reporter, Bob.
Well, okay. Well, anyway, speaking of somebody who really wanted Obama to succeed, first of all, we talked about after the Virginia Tech killings how he said something really tone deaf that seemed to minimize the magnitude of that, and I'm all for actually minimizing the magnitude of that, but I thought it was way overdone. But I'm not running for president, and he did it in a particularly tone deaf way. Okay, so now, you know, kind of famously, he was in this debate, and somebody said, "Would you, if elected president, immediately meet personally with who was it? You know, leaders of like you know, Syria, Iran, North Korea, Venezuela, blah,
Cuba,"
blah. And he says, I would immediately. First of all, I'm not really saying that if he were elected president, that kind of dramatic overture could not work. I think conceivably it could. But one thing that's clear to me is that in that political context, he should have known better than to answer the question in an unqualified fashion.
Well, it's weird. I couldn't tell if he thought taking the unnuanced stance was a political winner, and he wanted to have this fight with Hillary over whether he was a naive idealist on the grounds that naive idealists win Democratic primaries, or whether it was a gaffe, he didn't really mean to say it, and as long as he'd made the mistake, he thought it was better to stick with it than to backtrack.
Tell me this was the YouTube debate, right?
Correct.
Had they seen the questions in advance?
It's a good question.
Because Hillary
I don't think so.
Hillary jumped on this in a way that, for me, I mean, I was reading the transcript not thinking they had all seen the questions in advance. To me, the way she and then Edwards jumped on this was further evidence of how ill-advised it was. I mean, she didn't, she just nailed him.
She gave the same answer she would have given if he had never answered. In other words, if you'd asked her straight the question, she wouldn't have said, I will. She would have said, you know, no, I won't.
Exactly, which is what the prudent liberal does, in a campaign context, precisely because liberals have a reputation for being naively diplomatic, right?
But she didn't need to have planned that answer to give her that answer. So I think it was a spontaneous answer. It's weird that, you know, Hillary has since that debate soared in the poll, national polls. But there's some evidence that Obama isn't doing that badly in the Iowa polls. So it's possible that he is actually benefiting from his gaffe among the naive, idealistic activists, all three of them who trekked to the Iowa caucuses.
Okay, but then, so anyway, I really think alarm bells should have gone off before he answered that question. He should have realized, you know, A, I'm a Democrat, okay, and people worry about Democrats on the national security front. B, I'm a guy where people specifically worry that I don't have the seasoning to be, you know, to be in charge of the military and foreign policy. And so I think he should have been much more careful. So then after that, he does what I consider overcompensation with this Pakistan remark, right, where he says, if we have actionable intelligence about high-value targets and President Musharraf won't act, we will.
You don't deny that that's the right position. You just don't think one should say it, right?
Well, first of all, I don't think it's the right position in unqualified terms. You can imagine situations where there's high-value targets in Pakistan, and Musharraf hasn't acted. We know where they are, but for whatever reason, it's a really inauspicious time to do it, or, you know. So I wouldn't.
Right,
I don't think it would ever be. It makes sense in as unqualified. But
that's why the Democrats are so cheap to attack Rumsfeld for calling off a raid. There probably were pretty good reasons why he called off the raid. Maybe not.
But. Yeah. No, exactly. It's a complicated world. But in any event. It's the kind of thing you definitely shouldn't say if you're president, because clearly in this context, if you want Musharraf to succeed and he is nominally our ally, you do not want to further diminish his sovereignty, since you know the jihadists in Pakistan who wish his downfall are always harping on how he's an American puppet. Okay, so this is the last thing you'd say if you were president. And in fact, it turns out that Obama started a minor diplomatic incident by saying it as a candidate. The Pakistani.
Well, he may have helped Musharraf because he gave him an excuse to almost declare martial law.
Which he then did not do.
And so it probably did not strengthen him.
But I mean, half of the problem with this remark is also that it was so obviously a makeup call. It seemed to me that in the wake of that debate where he had sounded naively dovish, he comes off and starts playing. You know, I'm more hawkish than you are. I don't see the upside of that because, first of all, it's got to annoy some people in his base, the kind of netrootsy people in his base. The very substance of the remark. Secondly. It's so obvious to everyone that it's tactical in that context, right?
I agree completely with that.
So, I mean, this is just really, it seems to me, and then now, today's headline, or yesterday's, is Obama expresses sympathy for Musharraf. So he's just in this endless vacillation. And again, that was another makeup call. And this is coming from someone who really, you know, would like for him to have succeeded. But
Juan Cole said something on his side, which I thought was right, which is that a good politician knows how to back off such positions gracefully, and Obama doesn't seem to be that nimble.
Yeah, if he had to make up for the initial statement in the debate, a smarter thing would have been an explicit qualification of those remarks.
I agree. I agree with that. But all I can say is the night is young. You know, Hillary, for some reason, her essentially annoying qualities are not coming through in the debates. I blame her makeup, which is spectacularly good.
Yeah, but you know what? Is it my imagination, or are we seeing more unflattering pictures of her?
I think it's your imagination. We're seeing her with cleavage. Jesus.
Hey, we've got a dialogue on that coming up, Mickey.
Well, that's a summer ratings winner.
What? It wasn't planned. But it is coming from our cleavage correspondent. She is involved, our cleavage correspondent.
Who would that be?
You don't know who our breast correspondent is?
No, I don't.
Mickey, Ann Althaus.
Oh, of course.
But okay. but she had lined up this dialogue with a person before this person got in her own, got involved in the whole cleavage, Hillary cleavage issue. I'll keep people in suspense and say no more.
She is the go-to blogger for breasts.
For breasts, yes. But we didn't go to her for that. It just happened.
Okay.
Really.
But I haven't noticed that flattering pictures of...
Well, there was certainly one in Matt Iglesias' blog, but that was almost certainly not unintentional. But I think I've seen him in, like, the Washington Post. I mean, the thing about being a person who's getting on in the years and uses a lot of makeup is in the wrong light, you can look pretty bad.
But the debates are the right light. I mean, it was this debate in New Hampshire that where she discovered that she could look really good.
If you can set up the lighting, but it's all in the lighting. We spend hours before these. I have a whole staff that sets up the light. Spends hours.
That's what I found. I found that the lighting is very important for that blogging head's
now,
effect. I don't look anything like this in real life. I'm really...
Oh, I can vouch for that.
Yeah.
So you wanted to say something else about Obama-related, but on another issue?
Well, they also got in this fight over lobbying. The other big Obama-Hillary spat is equally senseless about, whether Hillary should take lobbyist money. And Obama and Edwards both jumped on her for doing that and portrayed her as a Washington insider. And she actually sort of dug in her heels a bit and defended her policy of taking money for lobbyists and said, believe it or not, lobbyists represent real Americans.
That was almost surprisingly, that was almost a little too candid for our own. Did it surprise you she would say that?
I like that because it was, A, it's true.
Well, yes,
and
I
B,
mean, well, all
B,
lobbyists
it's
represent real people, and some of them actually represent lower-income people.
It's a statement. I mean, the lobbyists for General Motors wants General Motors to stay in business. I'm sure the workers for General Motors want General Motors to stay in business, too. The head of the Teamsters was never more, Jackie Presser was never more effective than when he was corruptly, maintaining the Teamsters, stranglehold on the industry. Hillary does not seem like an insider Washington candidate to me, does she to you? She's not the creature of lobbyists. She's not Ted Stevens. Chris Dodd is much more a creature of lobbyists than she is.
Although I think on the Netroots and the foreign policy front, the fear is that she is a creature of the foreign policy establishment. That, first thing she'll do is make Dick Holbrook Secretary of State and... so on. But
that's true. But that's a different point. She's captive of the people around her. And it seems to me that's a legitimate critique. But the people around her include Ira Magaziner and Richard Holbrooke and a whole bunch of people who maybe we think have an insidious influence. The problem we learned from Clinton isn't so much that Clinton was on the take. The sort of the horror is the Mark Rich episode where Clinton did a really bad thing because he was basically effectively lobbied. And it was that his buddy, Jack Quinn, was being paid by Mark Rich. And it was sort of an illicit friendship. It was like, Clinton was led astray by his friend. Not just because wasn't because Quinn had given him campaign contributions, it's because Quinn was his buddy. And he stupidly trusted him. And so Quinn got this pardon from Mark Rich, though in retrospect was a really stupid thing to do. Hillary is susceptible to the same thing, but it has nothing to do with whether she takes campaign contributions from lobbyists or not. I mean, the biggest scumbags you get to her probably won't be lobbyists, technically. They'll be somebody else. And this idea that just because you're not a lobbyist, if you, the head of, AMCO Corporation, give bundle $1 million for Hillary, that you're not personally going to be able to call Hillary on the phone, even though you're not a lobbyist, and put in a good word for your company, is insane. That's the way people do business. They do it person to person. That said, I'm talking here, and you're not interrupting.
Well, but you did, but you got to a that said kind of punctuation, and I found that very reassuring. Go ahead.
That said, Mark Kleiman makes a very good point about lobbyists, which is I'd always wondered why why do corporations hire so many lobbyists? You know, why don't they just hire Tom Korologos and have him be the point guy? But instead, they hire like eight different lobbyists. And Kleiman, on his blog, has the answer, which is, you know, that's eight more people who can give the maximum limit within the campaign finance laws. So, in effect, lobbyists become a way of laundering corporate money because they take their salaries that you pay them and they give them as campaign contribution. And if you have 100 lobbyists, they can give 100 times more campaign funds than one lobbyist. I had just never realized that.
So campaign finance laws actually multiply lobbyists?
Well, they multiply the number of lobbyists that it's in the interest of any big mega corporation to hire, because you know with every new lobbyist you get $2,000 you can give to the candidate.
Ironic.
It is ironic, and it's a perverse consequence, I guess.
You've highlighted an irony, Mickey. Now, so your view is.
Do I get some sort of reward?
So who are you
reward?
For in the SPAT? The SPAT is I mean, Edwards and Obama are saying we don't take lobbyist money. And first of all, wait, Edwards takes a ton of money from trial lawyers, but sees a huge moral distinction between that and taking money from lobbyists?
Yes.
I mean, trial lawyers obviously have an interest in you know, tort reform and all that kind of stuff.
Yeah. And it's only Washington lobbyists. They're perfectly happy to take from statehouse lobbyists.
Uh-huh. Isn't it a real kind of disadvantage for Obama, say, to swear off of lobbyists? I mean, they have money. But he thinks it's worth the rhetorical edge.
I don't know if it's a good. I don't know if I suspect it's like PACs, which is it doesn't really kill them in fundraising, and it scores some moral points. So.
For a while he was doing so well in the internet fundraising and I don't know, for all I know he still is, but maybe he thought he could get by without it.
Well, I am surprised that if you read the amount of money that lobbyists have given to Hillary, it's not all that much.
Yeah, well, like maybe that the internet has now begun to dwarf what lobbyists.
Well, that's what I'm hoping, yes. But I understand why Hillary even bothers to take money if it's only.
And tell me this, I mean, I guess a feature of the internet money is that it is, in a sense, anonymous. In other words, those dollars are not associated with an obligation to any particular interest group. Because it's just these effectively anonymous people, even if they sign in with their email address, who gave you money through your website?
Well, I think it's very hard. It's harder for them to take credit. If you really wanted credit for your contribution, you would show up at a fundraiser or personally give the money to somebody, yeah.
Well, right. I mean, and it's the fundraiser typically that is associated with the interest, right?
Typically, although, you know, it's hard to buy somebody for $2,300 or $4,600, which is the amount you can contribute. So if you bundle a lot of contributions into $1 million, then you have some influence.
So internet fundraising could kind of be a good thing. Not for the commonly thought reason that, you know, people who give on the internet are they're all just regular people who don't have interest. I mean, everyone has an interest that, left unbridled, would exert a corrupting influence on the public policy's pursuit of the public good. But rather, the key thing is that the politician doesn't actually know what interest is represented by the money, right?
I guess that's right. I'm sure it traps politicians in other ways. In other words, if you're dependent on, anti-Iraq war, a mailing list for hundreds and hundreds of thousands of internet contributions, you can't, for example, say, hey, I think the surge is working, or else your fundraising will suddenly plummet. So you get trapped ideologically, and in a weird sense, being beholden to unprincipled Washington lobbyists gives you more flexibility and running room.
Now, we could use that reference to the surge as a brilliant segue.
That's dangling out there as a segue, Bob.
It's pretty much low-hanging fruit.
Yeah, I say take it.
We were going to talk about Iraq?
I think we are. There's all this press about how the surge is working, and there was this O'Hanlon
The
Pollack
famous
article,
O'Hanlon Pollack op-ed,
which has gotten an incredible ride based on as the left says, a completely exaggerated sense to which these are foes of the Iraq War who suddenly decide it's working. Well, they're supporters of the Iraq War who decided it was working.
Well, the way it's usually put is they've been harsh critics of the of the administration's prosecution of the war. Well, yeah, one reason they're such critics of the prosecution of it is they favor the war and they feel pretty damn embarrassed that it hasn't gone well. So and, the idea that they would not want to be optimistic is ludicrous.
And at this point, I always ask you, what blogger was most instrumental in promoting Kenneth Pollack's promotion of the Iraq War?
At which point I answer Josh Marshall, I guess?
Yes, absolutely.
The correct answer?
Absolutely.
I remember. But...
Well, Kaus Files held its fire. Josh Marshall promoted the war.
We favor accountability at Blogging Heads TV, whether it's Bear Stearns or liberal bloggers. I would say, though, in his favor, like, Josh started having grave doubts, I think,
before... Oh, no, he changed his mind before the war started.
Yeah, he wrote a very good piece for Washington Monthly.
But the piece in the Washington Monthly even was for the war. He just said...
No, but he wrote a piece with a great lead about how... It was one of those things he said, imagine... You know,
the
Middle East is in flames. He says, you know, that's not a bug, it's a feature. It's what the administration
wants,
basically.
Isn't that the one? There was one where he said, look, we should start the war, but not let Wolfowitz run it.
I don't know for sure.
I wonder if that was... Anyway.
That part turned out to be...
His net contribution to the war was heavily on the start the war side. He had last-minute doubts after he'd already launched the career of Kenneth Pollack, who now says the surge is working.
I'll let you and Josh email over that.
Well, we've already talked about why the surge, even though it's working, isn't enough, and it's the Joe Klein reason, which is even if the Sunnis have tossed out al-Qaeda, the Sunnis and Shiites are still at war with each other, so building up the Sunnis doesn't necessarily forestall the Sunni-Shiite civil war, and... as Phil Carter says, the Maliki government is rotten and sectarian to its core, so that any idea that somehow the surge is going to buy him breathing space is absurd. I don't quite understand this concept of breathing space. Do you? I've never understood it. It's one of these metaphors that it's a get up and get a beer metaphor.
Well, you mean the idea that the point of the surge is to keep the, you know, to subdue the violence to a point where Iraq can politically evolve?
Yes. It's somehow we're going to give Maliki breathing space, and I guess we pacify Iraq so that all of a sudden he can turn on his longtime allies?
Well, I guess it seems to me it is plausible that it's easier for the Iraq government to get its act together if fewer people are getting blown up than if more people are. But, I mean, one of the big critiques of the O'Hanlon-Pollack piece... The idea that there's cause for more optimism in certain realms than 6 months ago, I think, is not crazy. I mean, everyone kind of agrees now. It's a little auspicious that these, some of the Sunni tribesmen, as they call them, are allying with the U.S. And these are former insurgents, a lot of them, in order to get rid of al-Qaeda in Iraq.
Right.
That's all good. And maybe the surge in parts of Baghdad is working. The critique of O'Hanlon-Pollack that I think they kind of conceded later was that they just totally ignored the political situation in Iraq, where things seem to look just worse than ever. I mean, just this week, I think it's gotten to the point where half of the cabinet is no longer in the cabinet. I mean, already you would have had al-Sadr's Shiites drop out.
But that's like the credit crisis. I mean, that's like a momentary event that...
More and more. It's like, Mickey, I mean, I think the Sadr Shiites have been boycotting the cabinet meetings for a long time. And then
they dropped out of the government, didn't they?
Yeah, that's what I mean. And then a few weeks ago, yeah, it was more than a boycott. A few weeks ago, the Sunni contingent did. And then this week, the secular Shiite contingent at least suspended cooperation.
Well, all these people have hopes of getting rid of Maliki and substituting somebody else, so maybe they will. It's a parliamentary system. They can do that.
Yeah, I mean,
that's not necessarily a bad thing.
You actually have a tendency to dismiss superficially bad developments as being mere bargaining ploy. I think you said this about the second intifada about a decade ago.
In Arab parliamentary politics, they tend to be bargaining ploys. Yes, I've never seen one that didn't turn out in the end to be a bargaining ploy. You have a tendency to exaggerate whatever happens to be in the day's news.
I deny that.
And stop interrupting me. It's really annoying. But I mean, the key question has always seemed to me is, are we really trying to prop up a unitary government, or are we subtly setting the stage for when we leave some sort of balance of power between, you know, geographically defensible areas of sort of sectarian purity, so that we can have a de facto partition? And it does seem to be that we are, you know, still. The second strategy is the one associated with a piece Fred Kaplan wrote in Slate, which I thought I pretty much 100% agreed with, which is that, the best we can do is keep the surge going and set up conditions by aiding resettlement, set up conditions that so that when we leave, there's some sort of, there won't be a bloodbath because basically we separated the Shiites from the Sunnis. We don't seem to be doing that. In fact, today we're going after al-Sadr, presumably pursuing people who were killing Sunnis.
The incident where we killed a few dozen of his people in yes. Sadr City?
Today, when Maliki was out of the country, we took it upon ourselves to attack Sadr. And some people have said, I think Juan Cole, that this wasn't an accident. This was basically Petraeus trying to push Maliki around.
Yeah.
Not that that's necessarily a bad thing. But it seems to me if we really were subtly encouraging ethnic cleansing, we probably wouldn't do that, would we?
Well, I've been confused on that point. I don't know the answer to that, but I kind of agree with you that the smartest way to use what time we have at this point, it is to make the ethnic cleansing bloodless, as bloodless as possible, yeah. and to use it for relatively peaceful population transfer. And I guess that's what Fred Kaplan
right.
was.
But there's a fatal flaw in Kaplan's article, which I just noticed when I was rereading it before this show. He talks about how we could provide the means of transportation and safe passage to people who were Sunnis trapped in Shiite areas, i.e., Baghdad. And he says, Iraqi troops and police may be very keen to assist, if not lead the way in this mission, at least if Shiite forces are called on to help Shiites and Sunni forces to help Sunnis. Well, isn't that exactly what won't happen? The Sunnis aren't going to help the Sunnis evacuate Baghdad. Don't they want to stay in Baghdad?
Well, as I understand it, the Sunni position in Baghdad is almost hopeless at this point. But much of the cleansing has happened. It's now essentially a Shiite city, and the small pockets could never defend themselves in an actual.
Right, but 15% of the last I heard, maybe it's going down, but 15% of the city was still Sunni. That's in a city the size of Baghdad. That's
yeah,
still
but if it's leave or die, you want to help your brethren leave, right? Anyway, well, we can get Fred Kaplan on to defend himself.
I thought that was just an uncharacteristically over optimistic assertion by Fred that. It seems to me Sunnis are much more likely to. Shiites are much more likely to help Sunnis leave Baghdad than Sunnis are to help Sunnis leave Baghdad.
We will bring him on, and he will straighten this out.
Maybe everybody wants the Sunnis to leave Baghdad. Maybe that's the solution.
Yeah, I don't know. I mean, I continue to have hardly a clue of what the story is in Iraq. Can I make a little point?
You're so compelling visually that nobody cares that you don't have a clue. Yeah.
Can I make a tangential point about O'Hanlon Pollock piece? It's tangential to the piece, in fact, that is about Fox News.
Sure.
Isn't it the case that of course Fox News is right wing, fine, but doesn't Chris Wallace have a reputation as being among the, relatively speaking, the kind of real journalists, kind of not a partisan hack like Sean Hannity?
Yes.
Because, I mean, he said something about the O'Hanlon Pollock. I just happened to catch this walking by a TV set. That seemed to me, it was one of those cases where I think you can actually say, look, the guy's either ignorant or dishonest, and neither is something to be proud of if you're in his position. What he said was, he said, this op-ed piece by O'Hanlon and Pollock, and what's really interesting, and first of all, I said to myself, He's going to talk about the left-wing reaction and say that, you know, the left-wing's, the uproar over this optimistic assessment of the situation in Iraq just goes to show that the left, you know, doesn't really want to win. Well, whatever. But what he said, and that was the spirit of his remarks, but what he specifically said was the liberal blogosphere has turned on Ken Pollack and Michael O'Hanlon. Now, Mickey, what's wrong with that formulation?
Well, the liberal blogosphere has always hated
Ken Pollack and Michael O'Hanlon. Because they helped get us into this war. Ken Pollack was very influential precisely because he got so many liberals on board for this war. The liberal blogosphere, the anti-war blogosphere, has hated these guys all along. Now, do you think it's possible that Chris Wallace does not know that?
Yes.
You do? Really?
Don't underestimate the ignorance of network stars.
Mickey, that was such a condescending thing to say.
Condescending to, like, people who make millions of dollars a year? I'll condescend to them all at any time.
Okay.
Buddy, but you could be right. It could have been dishonest.
I'm questioning whether there are any real journalists on Fox TV is what I'm doing.
Britt Hume would certainly know. I don't think Britt Hume would say that.
Man, I'll tell you, though, but somebody... Look, Chris Wallace is not dumb. I mean...
That's right.
And if he's not, you know, cruising the blogosphere occasionally to get a sense of things, I don't know. Anyway.
Or if Britt Hume said that, he would definitely be being disingenuous.
Okay.
Let's put it that way. But I don't know Chris Wallace.
Okay. Can I take another tangent quickly?
Yes.
On your blog, did you make the argument that Rupert Murdoch's going to fire Paul Gigot or Gigot, depending on which one? It's Gigot, right?
Yes, I did.
Who's the head of the editorial apparatus in the Wall Street Journal.
Yes.
I don't get that, because aren't they... I mean, what's not to like, ideologically, from Murdoch's point of view?
Gigot is an ideologue, and Murdoch wants flexibility, for example, to suck up to China. Anybody you spend billions of dollars to buy something, you want to put your own people in. Murdoch wants somebody who he can call up and say, do this, and they'll do that. You know, Gigot has an independent heft, and he's not going to be a toady. So
we'll see.
Murdoch will want a toady, and then just these guys are dreaming if they think that the cult of Robert Barclay is going to continue with the Wall Street Journal. It's over. Even though they drew up some elaborate independence scheme, I think they're whistling past the graveyard. They're on the ship of fools.
Well, I don't doubt that ultimately Murdoch will have the power to fire him. It just seems like there's quite a bit of correspondence. I mean, wasn't the Journal pro-immigration reform?
No, they're congruent on immigration. Fox was...
And they were very pro-Iraq. So, I mean, unlike a lot of... It seems to me that what distinguishes them from a lot of conservatives distinguishes Murdoch from a lot of conservatives. Two main things. I mean, what distinguishes them from some of the conservative base is pro-immigration reform. What distinguishes them from actually a lot of the business community conservatives is they're like on foreign policy, you know, like crazily hawkish, right? Like Murdoch.
But what if Murdoch endorsed Tony Blair? What if Murdoch wants to endorse Hillary? You think Paul Gigot is going to write an editorial endorsing Hillary willingly? I don't think so.
I don't think Murdoch's going to want to endorse her in the general, but...
Well, it could happen. I mean, if it depends who he's running against. Maybe he has bad relations with Fred Thompson. He certainly has good relations with Hillary.
Well,
so, you know, he might be able to get more of what he wants from a Clinton administration.
If Ron Paul gets the Republican nomination, I think you may be right. Because Ron Paul didn't even favor immigration reform.
He didn't? How could he not have favored immigration reform? He's a libertarian.
I know, but one of the... I'm told, actually. I never read what I just said, but I am told by a knowledgeable libertarian that one place he departs from the libertarian gospel is that Ron Paul is quite opposed to... He's on your side of the immigration debate, I was told.
That's interesting. I like him better already.
Yeah, I thought so. He's from Texas.
The bizarre thing is Tancredo, who seems to be a hopeless candidate. He's been terrible in all the debates I've seen him. He has this ridiculous sign on his door that Ben Smith of Politico points out, which is he counts the number of sex crimes against children committed by illegal immigrants, as if that's an argument against, you know, against amnesty. And yet he's doing well and might, you know, in the Ames straw poll, he might come in second.
Mm-hmm. He might.
Because he has Pat Buchanan's people organizing for him. Who knew?
Not me. Thank you for sharing that.
I that was an up-to-the-minute political insight, Bob.
Mickey, I'm serious. Thank you for sharing.
You'd rather have your timeless, airy-fairy, you know, non-zero whatever.
Mickey, anyway. When I say thank you for sharing, it's never a joke. Thank you for sharing.
Everything you say sounds like a joke, Bob. If you said, if I was your wife and you said, I love you, I would think, why is he being ironic?
Don't worry, Mickey. If you were my wife, I wouldn't say it. Okay. But I love you, man. I do. And I mean,
see? I rest my case. What can I say?
Okay. Viewer comments?
Stop interrupting me.
What?
Stop interrupting me.
Viewer comments?
Yeah.
Okay. Quickly, I had this dialogue with David Frum. I didn't even know if you know you checked the site so infrequently, but I did.
I know you did. I did not see it.
However. And I got into this Axis of Evil business, and I got off in this pointless tangent about how really the historical meaning of evil, if you look at religions that have taken it seriously, is that there is some underlying unifying force behind all the really bad things that happen, you know?
Right.
And Lackluster, a commenter named Lackluster, it turns out to be a misnomer, by the way, as you'll see, makes a good point. That what the word evil actually means to people is it's the rejection of explanations for behavior. Ask questions about the motivations behind problems like terrorism and the Sean Hannitys of the world will shout at you that you don't understand evil. To, quote, understand evil, apparently, is to accept that your understanding of evil behavior begins and ends at the word. I think that's quite true. I mean, I did say to Frum, you know, the word evil shuts down rational thought, but I think this points to kind of the way it does it. Then Blogginoggin chimes in with adding that also in evil is the idea that one who is evil can't be redeemed no matter what. And I think that's kind of true. True also. So when you call somebody evil, you're saying, well, we can't understand what they're doing. They can never change. You just got to kill them. And I do think that that's the way people. That's why people on the right like the word in certain contexts. So this was an important clarification of thinking that came courtesy of our comment section, Mickey.
Well, but the polar opposite is the whatever that French phrase tout expliquer. It's to explain everything is to pardon everything. That would be the mistake that you veered toward.
No, I actually don't. I mean, I've written about this. I mean, as a practical matter, you have to punish people for doing bad things.
We have to pretend they have free will,
whether they do or not. Yes.
Okay, that's it.
But it's true that
another convincing, unironic statement from Bob Wright.
What?
Another convincing, honey, whether I love you or not, we have to behave as if I loved you.
I say that all the time. The surprising thing is it works, Mickey.
Okay,
you'd be amazed.
Once she's married to you, she's sort of stuck, right?
What?
Once your wife is married to you, she's stuck. She can't say, this guy's a little too ironic for me.
No, she could leave.
Yeah, but okay.
She's not here now. I'm alone.
Okay. Maybe she has.
Yeah. Well, I know. She's got the kids.
There's probably a note somewhere.
Yeah. So anyway, our commenters are brilliant. One more thing. I know you're going to give me a quiz at the end, but can I say one more thing? The Barry Bonds hit his 756th home run, breaking Hank Aaron's record.
Yes.
Okay, so you know where the eyes of the nation will now naturally turn, you know, the next great milestone of human achievement?
Bob's 100th Blogging Head episode.
Wrong. Two words for you, Blogging Noggin, Mickey. He's got about 950 comments now. He's closing in on the unprecedented 1,000 mark. And since, you know, we probably won't happen that when he reaches the mark, you and I happen to be in the middle of a dialogue, I wanted to go ahead now and salute him. I salute him. Do you salute him?
They're probably drug-aided.
Well, you know, I wondered about the eerie parallels between him and Barry Bonds. Do you think he's certainly been prolific lately, and I wondered about the possibility of anabolic steroids.
Well, I think we should form a commission.
Have an investigation.
I get Blogging Noggin and Garbage Cowboy confused.
They're easy to tell apart.
That's how intimate I am.
Oh, man. Garbage Cowboy's on your side. He's right wing.
Okay. I'm for him. Good. It's amazing how Bonds just came and went, and nobody really cares. Nobody
That's because everybody wants to forget it.
And nobody wants to remember.
They're already on to the next rumor. Now, Jose Canseco, former steroid-using baseball player, is suggesting that Alex Rodriguez, who just hit his 500th home run, the youngest person ever to hit 500, on track to break Barry Bonds' record, is himself a steroid user. So there.
Huh. Great.
You know, but I would also say that Blog and Noggin, for a prolific commenter, the quality of his comments is quite high, and often the length of them is pretty extensive. I mean,
is he the one who lives in Japan?
No, there's one who's called in Japan.
Oh, okay.
I don't know where Blog and Noggin is, but I know that the quality and quantity of his output compares favorably with some actual bloggers. But the last thing I'm going to do is mention names here, Mickey.
Is he the one who's also a blogger for Daily Kos?
Not that I know of.
Okay.
Possible.
Okay.
He seems less rabid than I mean, with all... Oh, no. I'm going to get it from Kidney Stones now. Never mind.
Kidney Stones is the guy I'm thinking of.
Yeah, Kidney Stones is a Kos.
But the Kos people aren't rabid, I thought we decided.
Okay, good. That got me out of that one. Thank you.
They're just pissy.
Yeah. So you're going to... What's the idea behind this quiz you're going to give me?
The idea behind the quiz is it's summer. We've been ignoring the important issues. You're an eminent intellect, Bob. You associate with the great minds of our time. And MSN, in its attempt to edify the public in the summer...
MSN or MSM?
MSN,
Microsoft Network.
Has come up with a format called the Big Debates, and there have been several big debates, and they ask discrete questions, and I just wanted to ask you in sort of rapid fire, I wanted to get your reaction as an informed American to these important questions.
And they're really not so important?
Will you be the judge?
Okay.
Bob? Jets versus Nick a year later, who really won?
Who versus Nicky?
You don't know who Jess and Nick are? Bob.
Nick. So is the point of this to accuse me of not having an intimate familiarity with pop culture, Mickey?
Correct.
Because, you know, one of our employees recently did that. He was doing some titling on this last one, and he had this title. And the title was, well, let me throw this at you. It's on the previous dialogue. The title is of one of the topics is iTunes Killed the Record Store Snob.
Well, that's an obvious reference to Video Killed the Radio Star.
Right, and so he emails me when he sends it in, like explaining that to me, so that I won't change the topic title.
Yeah,
I'm not so old that I don't remember that song, man.
No, you are old because you remember that song. That song was about 15 years ago.
That's what I mean. I'm old enough, but not too old. Whatever. I was insulted.
One walks a fine line between saying things you don't know about and insulting
you. So anyways, it's Nicky and who?
do you know who Jess is? Jess and Nick. That means nothing to you. Jessica and Nick. Jessica...
Not Valenti.
Jessica Valenti?
You don't know who she is?
No.
Nicky! It's pathetic. She's this blogger that the whole Ann Althaus thing was about.
Oh, right, right. She's the profiler. Right.
No, I don't think so. But anyway, go ahead.
She's feministing.
Okay, so the point of this is to make fun of me. Go ahead. Who's the next? Who are?
Should KFED get sole custody of the kids?
Who?
KFED.
Could you spell that?
K-FED. Man, you are out of it.
Yeah, I think she deserves custody of the kids. Is it a she?
Do you know who she is?
No.
You don't know who KFED is married to, was married to.
Who is KFED, Mickey?
Kevin Federline.
So it's not a she?
No, it's not a she.
Who is Kevin Federline?
Mr. Britney Spears. God, you're...
I know who Britney Spears is.
Well, good. Good for you. Is Nicole Richie crazy or couture?
Crazy.
You got one right. Was it a mistake for The View to hire Whoopi Goldberg?
No. I mean, you think I don't know who Whoopi Goldberg is?
No. It was tossing you an easy one. A softball.
No, I think it adds to the diversity of the cast. I like that.
Can Brad and Jen be friends?
I don't think so.
Yeah, you're right there. Did Tom kill Katie's career? Yes, the answer is yes.
Jesus. Is it? Well, see, yeah. I always thought, I don't know, how much political trouble you get into for opining on the attractiveness of people?
Big trouble.
Never mind.
Yes. Well, we're already in it with, you know, with Hillary, so.
No, I didn't say she was unattractive. I said she's like, you know.
Like all women.
My age, or even, I didn't say women.
Like all people who depend heavily on makeup, she takes a lot of bad pictures. As I believe.
But as long as we've broken that ground, I always thought there's a number of people, and this is just to demonstrate my mastery in pop culture, there's a number of people whose looks I don't think quite rise to kind of Hollywood star status, and yet are stars. And I think back in the good old days when I was young, they would not have been allowed to be stars. And I think Katie, whatever, what's her name, Holmes?
Well, there are a lot of people like that.
And you know, Britney Spears, speaking of that, right? Do you think she's really stunningly beautiful?
Well, now, when 5 years ago, yes.
Reese Witherspoon?
No, but
no, what? What are you saying?
No, she's not that beautiful, and no, she's not that funny.
She a comedian?
Yes, she's a comedian.
Is she?
She was in Legally Blonde, which I didn't see. Apparently, she was good in that.
Oh, well, she's a comedian. It's okay. They're not supposed to be attractive. That's okay.
But actresses are never that good looking because they have to be able to act. You know that.
Oh, yeah. Okay, never mind.
I mean, Bob, which one of us is in Hollywood who hobnobs with these people on a regular basis?
Well, maybe we can close on that note. Have you been to any good parties?
I don't think so. I see so many stars in the course of my day that it's sort of hard to single any of them out. But, no, the answer is no.
The answer is no, then. Are there any more questions in this quiz?
There are plenty of them, but I think I'll stop. Or do you think Paris Hilton's over?
I actually have a substantive opinion about Paris
Can
Hilton.
Can anything stop Paris? Is Paris on top or going bottoms up?
Well, for Paris Hilton, bottoms up is top. That's always been her niche, right?
There was a setup line. But anyways, yes. What's your opinion about Paris Hilton? This is good.
Is she the one who was started crying because when they wanted her to serve her jail time by actually being in jail rather than in her living
room? Correct.
Well, the substantive point is that when somebody's got a drinking problem, it was DWI, right?
Right.
Jail is where they should be. You're doing them a favor. Cold turkey. They'll wake up sober in a few days, and maybe that'll help them get a new start. If you let them go to their living room, they're just going to keep boozing it up.
That's a very good point. I thought you were going to say that the crying was actually a symptom of the drinking problem.
Oh, I'm sure it was related to substance abuse, yes.
But I was crying yesterday listening to K-Frog California Country, so that shows you the kind of mood
you
I
like
was
these
in.
weepy chick songs.
There were some of them.
Speaking finally of great songs.
Yeah.
A Regina Spektor song that's probably not even on any actual like CD or anything called One More Time with Feeling.
I believe it.
It's great.
You need a new person to follow up.
She's good.
I know she's good.
If I can find a way to link to that song, I will. I don't even know if it's officially available.
Okay, well.
I will email you this song. I've got it in MP3, and you will admit, I think, because it deals with some of your favorite themes.
Okay, well.
Medical establishment.
Okay, and I'll email you If Jesus Was a Cowboy by the Snake Handlers.
Sounds good.
An incredibly schlocky song that's perversely great.
Okay, well, so I'd wait to be convinced.
Okay. I think we're through.
I would say we were through about, half an hour ago.
Yeah, maybe more.
And it's only the hardcore that are still with us, Mickey.
Okay.
I salute them.
We've even lost Blog and Noggin. He's given up. He's not going for the record.
Well, he's probably taken to drink by now.
He's going over to Daily Kos and commenting there. Okay.